That is probably enough for tonight. We don't have a lot of time for clowning around. It's important to get on with our discussion. My topic tonight is regarding Christian literature that shook the world. I have prepared a series of notes, which everybody in the room should have. It's 7 pages of typographic errors and 4 sentences, but that's the way it goes. I've written them out rather fully because, being absent from a particular occasion, I thought you might profit by them best being able to see them in some detail. So you should have a set of these notes, and if you're very critical of them, then I will suggest that you give the next talk, or someone will suggest that. I have kind of regarded myself as the literati person in Ivry, among all the great scientists, plant physiologists, world end people, and all the others that do things, because, as I mentioned in my notes, I have a feeling that the social sciences have to be balanced with everything else in any kind of interdisciplinary subject. If you don't have them balanced, then you easily become off-centered and can take all sorts of strange views in life. That's what's happened to Francis Crick, I think. A failure to appreciate the social sciences has turned him into a kind of a thinking machine, destructive of humanity if you push it far enough. But whatever the case happens to be, when Dr. Peterson asked me about another Ivry talk, I have been thinking for some time about these works of Christians that had a pronounced effect on the society in which they lived. Not just another good book, but something that really shook the masses, and sometimes shook them for generations to come. I said to myself, can't we learn from those things? Can't we analyze things that have been greatly used and very encouraging in time past? Can't we learn from those things in a way that will enable us to challenge our society more fully than we're now doing? I think we have to realize that the whole media world has changed a great deal, and whereas at one time the book was about the only thing there was, today there's radio and television and 17 or 18 other things of communicating to particular people. So the idea that now a book will upset the world or turn it over is not as realistic as it might have been 400 years ago when people really read them. And yet still, there's a massive market for literature, and books hold an enormous place in the thinking of people in general and of mind formers in particular. So it strikes me that that's what we're looking at in our discussion this evening. Christian literature that literally shook the world in its day. And out of that, we want to glean some ideas and opinions of how we might contribute in the world of a media that, by and large, is controlled by secular forces. We don't want to become secular, but how we can contribute in a world that's controlled by forces that are, by and large, forces of that sort, and consequently hostile to much that we want to do. You'll have to forgive me if I play with papers here. There's not a lot of room on this desk, and the paper image gets kind of scattered around as far as our circumstances are concerned. But a good lecturer always waves a couple of papers back and forth. It proves to his audience that he has notes, and they always feel better thereby. I will stick pretty much with the printed notes, although I shan't read them exactly, but I'll stick pretty much with them, and you can work along with me on them. The particular books that I've selected, I mentioned on page 1 and 2, are from 4, you couldn't say different eras, but from 4 expressive periods. I've chosen the work Lex Rex by Samuel Rutherford. I will say something about the author bit by bit, but that's my first selection. It's the oldest one published in this group. Following that, I've selected the work on Pilgrim's Progress by Bunyan. Most of you have read it. I'm still looking for one with lots of pictures myself, but Pilgrim's Progress by Bunyan. The third of them is William Booth's book, In Darkest England and the Way Out, a fascinating book written, in 1890. That's close to 100 years ago, but really an epochal book in its day. And the last of these is the book of Lindsay a few years ago, entitled The Late Great Planet Earth, all of which concepts you may or may not agree. That's kind of irrelevant. The point is that the book had a great impact. And working from something that occurred back in the days of the Puritan age in England down to the present time, over a span of about 300 years, almost exactly a span of 300 years, we're saying, here's some great Christian literature that shook the world. What can we learn from that as far as our shaking the world is concerned? I mentioned that these are 4 types of literature. They are not the same. It's not like 4 novels or 4 powerful polemics, not like 4 works in the apologetic, but 4 types of literature. One is essentially political and constitutional. One is essentially societal. One is essentially spiritual in the aspirations of Christian life and learning. And the fourth is essentially a general appeal to the masses of mankind to face realistically the potential terror which the author thinks is ahead of us, which he thinks cannot be avoided. So we're working with 4 types of books. We're working essentially with 4 types of audiences as well. And yet the one thing in common the books have with the audiences is that they are pieces of literature that literally shook the world. I'm, of course, borrowing that phrase and kind of carrying it around from the Acts concept of turning the world upside down, but literature that moved in a powerful way on the society of its day. Now, the procedure that I will follow, as I mentioned on page 2, is that we will take each of these works in the order in which they are given. The given on my page is spelled with a T, but you understand that that's the old English way of spelling it, especially if your fingers miss the typewriter. In the order given, I will tell something about each of the authors, a little bit about each of the work, a little bit about the intentions given them, a little bit about the influence, and then having done that, I will try to draw some conclusions, and the night will be over. Refreshments are being served downstairs again, I understand. So it'll be plenty of time to run down and get a mouthful of cookie left over from the last degree meeting. But that was only a few weeks ago, so there still is a precious day, and a little punch or something like that to wash it all down with. So that's what we're doing in our occasion for this every talk today. Books, Christian literature that shook the world. That's all prolegomena. That's out of the way. On page 2, we go to our discussion session with regard to Rutherford's books, Lex Rex, or The Law and the Prince, comma, A Dispute for the Just Prerogatives of King and People, published in 1644. Now, following my general arrangement of things, I mention a few words about the author, Samuel Rutherford. We cannot go into great detail on Rutherford's life, I don't think, just because that isn't our particular discussion. He's better known among persons in our work for the letters that he wrote from prison. He was imprisoned as a nonconformist preacher in 1636 and spent 2 years in the Aberdeen jail. He was put there under the indeterminate sentence of as long as the king pleased. The plea of the king pleased to keep him there 2 years. The king released a lot of Scots preachers in 1638 because of the work of the Solemn League and Covenant and the impending revolution in Scotland. And Charles kind of threw him a little plum by letting some of their preachers out of jail. What Charles failed to realize was that a preacher who has been jailed and let out is about twice as dangerous as one who jailed and keep in. So men like Rutherford and others returned to their parish in 1638, full of good sermons, I think, but also full of hostile king sermons, hostile to Charles, at least, in the scope of things. Rutherford had been in the ministry for some years. He would later become a theologian. He would later teach in a number of colleges. I don't think I need to say very much about that, but all of his sympathies were nonconformist. It's important to remember that nonconformist did not mean a radical or a rebel necessarily. It meant someone who stood outside the established church. And by established church, of course, we mean the Church of England, which had been commissioned by the Parliament and put in full authority. And since the days of James I, there had been a continuing intrusion of the rules of the Church of England into Scotland. Those things were really pushed on in great force in 1636 and 7 by William Law, the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And they became very odious to the Scots, and so many of them stood outside the established church. Hence, they are called nonconformists. In the terms of what we see in nonconformity in our world today, they are kind of playing games to some degree, but they wanted their own service, their own order, and so they stood outside the church. And that was the particular circumstance in which Rutherford saw himself, a nonconformist. He would be that in effect all of his life. When Parliament and the King split in the Revolution of 1640 and 1641, which eventually dragged on until the time when Charles was beheaded, when Parliament split, Parliament took a move towards nonconformity itself. It actually outlawed for a little while Anglicanism, and it thought seriously of making Presbyterianism the rule of the land. It never really did that. It thought it. It soon fell under the control, in a general sense, of Oliver Cromwell, who was an independent. So in many ways, England, from about 1643 to 1658, was a land of religious independence and independent expression. At that particular time, Parliament, wondering about better rules for England, convened the Westminster Assembly in 1643, and Rutherford was an attendant at the Westminster Assembly, being one of the voting and working members there. The idea of the Assembly was to produce a new creed, a new statement, a new church, really. Now, that's a little over severe, but that's really what they were going to do. They were going to rewrite the religious fabric of England to replace the Church of England. It did not really work that way because the Church of England, though young, was still ingrained in the people. And the people were not ready for Presbyterianism, and they were not ready for independency, per se. So the confession produced a lot of great works. I'm sorry. The assembly produced a lot of great works, but most of those works had relatively little effect in England of its time, and mostly had effects later in Scotland and America. Among those, of course, is the Westminster Assembly. But Rutherford was there in 1643, working hard, can you see it, on the establishment of a new religious constitution, so to speak. That's a so to speak, but a new religious constitution for the English people. In that circumstance, he studied night and day on other things, too, and in 1644 produced Lex Rex, which is a dispute for the just prerogatives of king and people, the law and the prince. I think we have to understand those embattlements politically to understand what he will do in Lex Rex. But I will tell you that immediately the book created some controversy, because while the king was not in good force and not in good understanding, there were a lot of other problems in England. People were just not ready to jump into something big in a hurry. So the book was not immediately received wildly. In fact, it was hardly received at all until about 1658, when it was received by Rutherford's enemies. And then with the return of Charles II, 2 years later, Rutherford would have been in great difficulty, but he died of natural causes before he could be brought. They'd actually put out a summons for him for treason, but he died before that could be enacted on. So much for Samuel Rutherford. As far as we can tell of him, from our point of view, he was a thoroughly evangelical and biblically oriented scholar with a tremendous interest in the gospel, but also with a great interest in a government that was biblical and non-oppressive of the things that related to God. Now, of the book itself, there are a few things that can be said with regard to Lex Rex that are fairly important. In precis form, as I mentioned on page 2, it was a challenge to the divine right of kings and other political systems. The divine right of kings was largely a concoction that took the concept that the state was invested by God with its power in Romans 13 and made the king a supreme tyrant with the right to do what he would regardless of what individuals might think or how it might touch an individual freedom. I'm not at this time going to argue about governmental ideas, but that's essentially what it was. It effectively gave the king the same sort of powers that the Lord will have in the millennium. Most kings in this life are not worthy of those. In England, the divine right was counterbalanced by the old Magna Carta and by a number of constitutional ideals thrust on the King of England through its long history. So that in the days of Rutherford, the English king was not nearly as powerful as he had been, say, 400 years before, although considerably more powerful than the royalty figures are in England today. But Rutherford's concept was to go against the divine right, not against the right of kings to rule, but the idea that the king was supreme in whatever he thought or he said. Rutherford was opposed to that idea. His concept was that the king was balanced by the scripture and that the people must see to it that the king was so balanced. To obey a bad government, said Rutherford, was rebellion against God, period. He didn't take the view, as so many of them. These things, some of them are expounded very much by Whitehead in this work, The Second American Revolution. Some of them are expounded by Whitehead and some are kind of missed by Whitehead. But on this particular point, Whitehead makes a big thrust that Rutherford's view of the king was not that he was ordained by God, so if he told you to get down and kiss the feet of Baal, you had to do it. Or if he made something that was equally bad but not religious, you had to do it. The concept of Rutherford was that government was only valid as long as it ruled with respect to God. It didn't necessarily have to be a spiritual government. You could have a ruler that was not a spiritual person if he honored God and honored the law of God. But for the believer, the individual, to obey a bad government was rebellion against God, whereas to defy a bad government was harmonious with the divine will. In Lex Rex, the two binding functions, well, maybe I shouldn't say two. I think I say two in my notes. I don't have time to read it right now. But the two great functions in Lex Rex were the concept of covenant, the king and the people united together in a common understanding, and then also the concept that all men are created equal. Those were two big forces in Lex Rex. So consequently, even though you are the king, you are no more free to defy God than I am, who am a peasant. See, here you're the peasant, here you're the king. Neither one of you is more free to defy God. In fact, we could say neither one of you is free to defy God. Hence, the king has no prerogative of acting contrary to God above what the common citizen would have. So the common citizen disobeys God, you slap him in the jug. or whatever they called it in those days. I'm being a little facetious there, but that's the idea. The king disobeys God. There has to be some way of dealing with him too. The nature of his level may give him some degrees of immunity, but not when it comes to God. This has to be understood in the common concept of the believer standing there with the king. So in government, believer and king make an agreement, a covenant together, like a restatement of something like the Magna Carta. They make it together, and then the king fulfills his part in agreement with the word of God. The common person fulfills his part in agreement with the word of God, always remembering that they are both equal before God, the equality of persons. There are many other things that stand out in Lex Rex, but those are two dominant factors along that law. Now, to obey bad government is rebellion against God. So what do you do when the government is thoroughly bad? Well, when the government is thoroughly bad, you first of all protest in whatever means are available to you. There are a number of those specified in Lex, but whatever means are available to you, you protest. Secondly, you run like crazy. Taylor's estimation of Rutherford's concept of flight. Now, these two points, as I mentioned in my notes, are very similar to what Menno Simons would say on the continent many 100 years before Rutherford. He will not take Rutherford's third point, but that was Simon's idea exactly. You protest in what ways are available, and you go as fast as you can somewhere else when you can. And the third step is to actually take forceful objection to what the government does. Rutherford doesn't believe in anarchy. He doesn't promote the fact that people should just jet up and jump leaders and shoot leaders, but there may be many ways of taking strong opposition, and eventually, revolution may be the only thing that's left. Eventually, force made all that's left. The concept is that you do those things because government is given by God, but government that is anti-God is not worthy of being obeyed. So that, in essence, is what Lex Rex is about. That's a hopeless oversimplification, but that, in essence, is what it is about. My criticism on page 2 and 3 is that it's strong in logic and argument, but not particularly strong in biblical exegesis and the careful working out of biblical text. And I always say to myself, smiling, you can't do everything in one book. Some of you in the IBRI audience may have read these things. If you think I'm too simplified on them, that's what most of my students think in most of my courses. But that's pretty much the way it goes. More of that work has been done, and more publications and studies of Lex Rex have been worked out of the Rutherford Foundation in Maryland in the last few years. I offer then a few notes on the influence of the work. The influence. Well, in his day, Lex Rex was not much of an influence because the nation turned back to royalty in 1660, and as I said earlier, Rutherford was under a summons when he died. Men who held Rutherford's opinions spent most of the next few years in jail somewhere. But with the Glorious Revolution in 1688, and with the coming of William and Mary, and the reconstitution of the English people, Lex Rex became a big focus with regard to the new covenant, the agreement between the king and the people of England, Parliament in particular. So that the ideas in Lex Rex were brought into focus in a very sharp way with what we would call the new English Constitution of 1690 following the rebellion, particularly with regard to getting a covenantal arrangement with the king. Unfortunately, there wasn't the strong stress in biblical things that we would like to see, but with regard to getting a strong stress on the relations that the people held with the king. And I might add that that covenantal relationship would prove to be a real thorn in the flesh to George III 75 years later when the revolution broke out and things of those particular things happened. But Lex Rex had a big pull with regard to the new English thing. You'll also recognize the common ideas that it had with the Declaration of Independence, all men being created equal. Now, that's not equal in the sense that they've all got the same brains or muscles, but with regard to their stand before God and their accountability to God, they're viewed as being equal. We are not sure that the men like Thomas Jefferson, we're not sure what he knew of Rutherford, although, see, these men are not so terribly far apart in history as you might imagine. We're not so sure what he knew of Rutherford. But one of the key men in the Declaration of Independence was Witherspoon, the Presbyterian theologian from Philadelphia. He's the only theologian to sign the Declaration of Independence. He'd more recently come from Scotland, where he'd been part of the non-conforming ideology in Scotland, opposing all sorts of Anglicanism and whatnot. Witherspoon is much more important in the Declaration of Independence and in the American Revolution than many scholars credit him for, because he supplied the moral and theological motif behind what was actually done. And our impression is that Witherspoon carried with him Rutherford's ideas and brought them to the Declaration people and said, look, he said, all men are created equal. The king in England is no better than a fellow lounging in front of a pub in Boston. Probably Rutherford Witherspoon didn't say that, but that's the idea, that men are created in an equal sense in their concept before God. And under that concept, they have the right to bargain, if you please, for the dictates of government and what the law ought to be concerned with. So we look and see that a work like Rutherford's reshaped, to some degree, the English establishment and powerfully reshaped parts of the American establishment as well. Beyond that, it has given rise to theological and political debates in the past years that maybe haven't been of that great a consequence. But what observations do we make on Lex Rex? It is, first of all, a political, civil type of work, given a base in biblical things, but not really an exegetical, theological treatise, as I would define it. It's also aimed at a particular mindset of people, people who are governing and controlled, responsible for government. It's hardly written for shoeblacks, although they probably would be able to understand it with a little work. But it's chiefly written in a way to avoid what we would call provincialism and limited means to appeal for common understandings of government by people wherever they live and under whatever circumstances they are. Maybe they're pilgrims on the Mayflower writing a compact. That, of course, was done before Lex Rex was written, but I'm just using it in a backward sort of an illustrative type thing. Wherever they happen to be, that there's a right of people to bargain for a government that will honor the scripture. Mind you, this is not a government that defies God, but a government that obeys God. So my observations on Lex Rex are simply this. You'll note that the great influence is exerted, and is largely because it avoids provincialisms and it deals with issues that are close to the heart of every party. And by being very pragmatic and not ideal, and by being universal and not provincial, it provides grounds for governmental thrust to continue to rattle throughout much of the Western world and some of the Eastern world too. Well, I have to leave Rutherford there and press on to my second volume. Time gets away from me, these things. I have a tendency to get too many incidental remarks thrown in anyhow, but so far I've not told any army stories, any little boy stories, or anything that happened in seminary in the last week. The second of our books is the work by Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. There's hardly anybody who hasn't read it in some form. Banner of Truth came out a couple of years ago with Pilgrim's Progress in a total comic edition, about 60 pages, and lovely comic pictures, 12 on a page. I tried to get another copy of it. I made the mistake of giving mine away. It seems to have been gone forever. It was cheaply done, but it was beautiful and useful. Pilgrim's Progress. Full title, The Pilgrim's Progress, From This World to That Which Is to Come. The author is John Bunyan. Like Rutherford, he was a nonconformist preacher. Unlike Rutherford, he was not educated hardly at all. He was self-taught. We are told that he learned English and the knowledge of English and whatnot simply from reading the Bible over and over again and again, even long before he was converted. He was a man who struggled with the concepts of grace. Was actually much influenced towards understanding grace through hearing Luther's preface to Romans being read, much the same way Wesley would be helped years and years later. Bunyan was one of those men who, I would say, in lots of ways, was emotionally not settled all of his lifetime. But a good man, don't misread me on that, a good man, but emotionally not settled all of his lifetime. He fought against the forces of the king in the Revolution or the Civil War in England, although he is about a whole generation younger than Rutherford. And when the war was over, he became the member of a nonconformist church in the town of Bedford, near where he was born, raised, and spent most all of his lifetime. And nonconformity, see, as I said before, is the concept of having a religious expression outside the established or the settled church. The established church, the preachers of it, were paid by the state. And nonconformists, the preachers could work for a living or pick up free will offerings, whatever seemed to promise the most in those days. Bunyan was apparently a good preacher, and especially a good street preacher. He was especially strong of voice, and he had quite a following in Bedford until 1660, when the crown returned. In 1660, all of the nonconformists were ordered to stop preaching. You'll remember in church history that in the next 10 years, from 1660 to 1670, there were a whole bunch of repressive acts passed. But Bunyan was ordered to stop preaching. He would not do it, so in 1670, 1660, he was deposited in the Bedford jail. He would be in and out of Bedford jail for the next 12 years. 1660 to 1672, he was in jail most of the time. After 1672, sometimes it's hard to get the dates right twice in the same paragraph, but after 1672, he was released from the prison and spent the last 16 years of his life preaching in various places. But the thing that saved him there was that he was the established pastor of a recognized church in the independent strain. They had to be careful what they did, but they were allowed to operate with a lot of restrictions, a lot of harassment, and an awful lot of criticism. It was during his time in the Bedford jail that he did the great bulk of his writing. And all of Bunyan is interesting to read, I think. An awful lot of it, almost all of it, is allegory, stories and dreams and visions and similitudes, but it's very interesting to read. Theologically, as I mentioned, I think, in my notes, Bunyan is a composite. He's a great follower of what we would call sovereign grace while preaching a straight gospel, a strong gospel. But in terms of polity and various other things, he was not really with the Presbyterians. He was an independent. We've always chuckled at Bunyan when it came to baptism. He could baptize anybody, any way, at any time, anyhow. Whatever the case was, his views were not very fixed, and consequently would have trouble in the present circles today where you've got to be pretty certain of all those things to be liked by almost anybody. An interesting sort of fellow. His life is a strange collection of a man who varies from strong points to weak points. But as a nonconformist theologian, he was enormously taken up with the concept of practical outworkings of holiness. That's what Pilgrim's Progress is. I come to the book itself. It is essentially the outworkings of practical holiness. That is essentially what it is. It recounts the journey of the individual believer from ruin to blessing, from the city of destruction on to Zion. Pilgrim staggers along with his burden until he comes to the cross. You'll remember he goes through the Slough of Despond and other things until he comes to the cross. And then at the cross, he's relieved of his burden. The law of Moses is delivered from him, and he's free from the burden of sin. And from that point on, he perseveres, like a good Calvinist would, through many things in the course of life. He goes by the giants and the difficulties. He goes by the touching moments of Vanity Fair where poor Faithful is killed. He goes through martyrdom attempts and all sorts of other things while he continues showing how by trust in the word and the grace of God, one perseveres and one overcomes. And Bunyan is saying to the religious community of his day, there is no shortcut to spiritual success, no shortcut to God's will. All that is really available to us is conformity to what God says, trust in him, belief in his son, and continuance on the things that God wants us to do. It is a very powerful narrative. It shows the force of grace in our lives, as I mentioned, and the necessity of commitment. So it's written to what we would call today a soft society, but it really wasn't soft by our standards. It was a society in which good men were in jail, but there were an awful lot of people in that society who, when the king came back, closed their Bibles and shut their doors and accepted the rule of royalty very meekly indeed. That Parliament, who had been so strong during Cromwell's day with nonconformity rules, that Parliament, in just a few years, could be putting out the Test Act and the 5 Mile Act and one conventicle act after another, showed the vacillating nature of that body and the lack of any real commitment to biblical truths that those particular parties held. So in Bunyan's point of view, it was a soft society. I hate to think what he would think about our society. And to that society, he said, what you have to have is the grace of God, and then you have to persevere in that grace, overcoming the things that the world sets before you. It is a strange and powerful book along those particular lines. It's the sort of thing, when you read it, it's hard to realize the influence that it's had in the totality of our society. The Pilgrim's Progress is written in two parts, as I mentioned. The second part hardly anybody reads, I think. Not sure about that. Maybe in a group like this, everybody's read. But the second part recounts how his wife and children made it to Zion too. You'll remember in the first part, when somebody says to him, where's your family? They stood like the others and laughed in scorn. But in part two, his Bunyan's wife and daughters make it also. I'm not laughing at that. I'm just telling you that that's how it goes, to complete the family in Zion, tracking their trails through that particular circumstance. Most of us, in reading Pilgrim's Progress, came to where he got there. We sighed a big sigh of relief, and we're glad he was there, and just assumed that the rest of the book was footnotes or something like that, and let it stand that way. But whatever the case happens to be, the second half is somewhat anticlimactic to the first. The appeal of Bunyan is to the man or the person who looked for bliss and hope to find that bliss through a staunch form of Christian living. Consequently, the power of the book is in rugged characterization and personification of forces that were generally well known, but not really thought about to the sea. Vanity Fair, everybody knows the concepts, but until it's sketched by Bunyan in a powerful way, it's hard to realize the grip and pull it has on mankind in general. A lot more can be said about Pilgrim's Progress. It's been made into many, many films and so forth, but I will say something about the influence of the work. Well, the fact that it's been through hundreds of editions ought to be testimonial to its influence in itself. Nobody republishes and re-edits a book that doesn't mean anything. Believe me, there are thousands of books in the library that nobody has ever touched. The very fact that a book is re-edited hundreds of times is proof of the fact that it has a powerful grip and heart on the influence of people. Proof of it itself. I don't have an exact count of how many times Bunyan's book has been reprinted. It has been hundreds of times, republished hundreds of times. I was in a bookstore not many years ago, and a man showed me, he had a full set of Isaac Walton's The Complete Angler. One volume, it had been gone through something like, at that time, 1,800 editions. 1,800 editions, most of us haven't read it, most of us don't fish that much, but 1,800 editions. And the man said to me, he said, "That's a lot." I said, "Is that a record?" "No," he said, "compared to Pilgrim's Progress," he said, "that's just getting started." But I didn't ask him how many editions Pilgrim's Progress had gone through. But gone through hundreds, translated into dozens of languages, and parroted by lots of others, like Nathaniel Hawthorne's Celestial Railroad. You'd hardly believe that a gloomy fellow like him would take up writing like that, but that's the way it goes. Hundreds of other parodies in Pilgrim's Progress, right down into our present age, in which people try to do what Bunyan did. They try to personify the forces of evil and put them against the rugged characterization of a believer who's slugging his way through. So that while Lex Rex, or Rex Lex, well, whatever it is, while it is a political innovation, Pilgrim's Progress challenges one spiritually for commitment and devotion to Christ. And yet it's written realistically because the forces that are faced by Pilgrim, or Christian if you will, the forces that are faced by him are easily identifiable in the world where you and I live. We see those forces. We know them. Nobody has to explain them to us in very great detail beyond the explanation that Bunyan already gives. So the influence of his work in touching lives to make them think of eternal things was enormous. Now, unfortunately, in the day and age in which I live, when I first read Pilgrim's Progress, it was just a good story recommended in school, that's all. Good story recommended in school. I read it and hardly understood what it was about. Years later, when I read as a believer, I gained a great deal more insight into it. I don't know if we could say how many people have been touched for the gospel by it. Certainly in the history of the church, a lot of people have. But the impact that it's made in teaching people on what to beware of and what to do is a very powerful impact. And that's where the influence of it lies. What contributes to that life? The thing that contributes to that life is the reality in which Bunyan treats the world of his day and the challenges that come to the believer. So let me make a few observations. In the case of Pilgrim's Progress, vividness of language, familiarity of English, I'm sorry, familiarity of image, the words look the same the way I type them. Vividness of language, familiarity of image, simplicity of theme, those things mark Pilgrim's Progress for what it happens to be. And they are the things that speak to people in every age. I do understand that some editions have been written in a more modern English. I've read three or four myself. They no doubt are good. But in all sorts, the force that Bunyan put to it is so easily carried from one generation to the next. That, you know, the son doesn't think he's reading something that was stupid, while the grandfather thinks it's great. The concepts are realistic and vividly presented. And that made the work a great success. Well, if you're still with us and haven't fallen asleep, once or twice in these talks, I've cautioned people if they fall asleep, they do so at their own risk because none of the healers are very good friends of mine. So if you're still with us and you haven't fallen asleep or you haven't collapsed or hadn't wished you'd gone to watch the wrestling or something like that, I will press ahead and tack on these next two books. I'm sorry that there's no time for questions. Oh, there is time. It's just that I can't hear them. I should be preaching in Pendel tonight, so it's hard to hear those things. If there are questions of considerable substance, I'd write them out and give them to Dr. Newman, who will put them with his file of questions student asks, which are to be answered sometime shortly after the millennium begins. I'm kind of sorry about that. But in the last two times I've spoken at IBRI, there's only been one question asked, person, just one, and I think that question was, how much did that book cost? So there might be heavier ones tonight. But the third of these books is William Booth's In Darkest England and The Way Out. This is a book the existence of which I was utterly unaware of until just a few years ago, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago maybe. You'd say it can't be a very important book if you weren't aware of it. No, the truth is that there are thousands of important books that I'm not aware of. It's not until you get working in history that you find out where the great evidences are. And as I've said two or three times, I'm not telling you these were the greatest books, but that these were Christian books that shook the world. William Booth, who died in 1912, in one of the largest funerals, well, he didn't die in the funeral, but died in 1912. His funeral was one of the largest of this century up to this modern day and age. Thousands and thousands of people, kings, queens, and diplomats being there. But William Booth had been a Methodist preacher. He served at the Methodist New Connection in England and became an independent evangelist in 1865. The Methodists wanted him to stay in one place, but Booth said, "This whole city is my parish." That was London. And so not wanting to stay in one place, he left them and became an independent evangelist in 1865. Booth's theology, contrary to Rutherford and Bunyan, is largely Arminian in tone, or Wesleyan might be a better word for it, in the day and age in which we live. But he was a strong preacher and committed along ministerial lines to the gospel in a powerful sort of way. It's easy to misunderstand him by virtue of some of the things that were said, I suppose, and some of the aspects of his ministry, because he was constantly working and reaching out, helping and doing things for the poor. But it has to be remembered that Booth, more than anything else, was a proclaimer of the gospel. And so he tells of one of the particular works, this particular notation, which I'm picking up from Petrie's work on a history of Christianity. He says with regard to the general thing, "My only hope for the permanent deliverance of mankind from misery, either in this world or in the next, is the regeneration or remaking of the individual by the power of the Holy Ghost through Jesus Christ. But in providing for the relief of temporal misery, I reckon that I am only making it easy where it is now difficult, and possible where it is now all but impossible for men and women to find their way to the cross of Christ." An interesting aspect with regard to William Booth. Booth, in 1865, founded the Christian Mission in London, and before long he was giving out much that was free and helpful to the people. When I say free, I don't mean that exactly. In 1872, he organized the work known as Food for the Millions. Booth was a believer in selling things, but selling them at a pittance. And then if you didn't have the pittance, then he would give it to you. Booth said that people valued things more when they realized the price and the source of them. So if a person had absolutely nothing, Booth would feed him. But if he had a halfpence, Booth would take the halfpence for the meal or whatever else could come by. He felt that that was essential in making people feel the responsibility of life. To simply make people freeloaders, Booth thought, was to discourage them from ever being productive. In 1878, he organized the Salvation Army as a formal body, and they in turn gave him the term general, which he carried to his death. You can hardly imagine the chagrin and difficulty that the army went through in the first 50 years of its history. I'm not getting into that. That's another subject. But the army was enormously persecuted, really persecuted, by everybody from Anglicans to simple Baptists, up and down and back. They were particularly bothered. I'm sorry, they were particularly bothersome in the towns where they decided to have anti-saloon campaigns and had them by marches up and down the street past all the saloons, going by, blowing their horns, and shouting anti-drink slogans as they went. Not sure if that's how we ought to conduct ourselves, but the army was enormously persecuted in England. At times, the War Training College was attacked by mobs, and the recruits stoned and beaten and spat on and all sorts of other things. And yet Booth noted that the blood of the martyrs had been the seed of the church. He was quoting somebody else, but Booth noted that, and noted that all the struggles that came to them merely gave them more purpose for what they were doing. His wife Catherine was quite a strong helper with Booth too, and his family continued to work after his demise. That's all I can say for William Booth. A fascinating character. He preached almost endlessly. He was one of the first of the modern preachers to make great use of the automobile, as automobile tours around Britain and other places stopping and preaching here and there. He was not known to us as a great man of literature, although he pioneered magazines and put out literature and tracts in great numbers. But in big literary production, we do not pay a lot of attention to it. However, his book, In Darkest England and the Way Out, was a bombshell in its day, created a virtual societal revolution in London, and did more probably to help the poor practically than anything had been done in England for hundreds of years. So let's chat about the book itself. Now, Booth did not write the book from a theoretical basis. He started his work in London in 1865. The book was not written until 1890. 1890 is the publishing date for In Darkest England and The Way Out. So Booth, by that time, had had 25 years of hard work in the slums of England. For 12 years, he had been running the Salvation Army and its many food stations around the city, where clothing and food and other helpful things were given out. Booth represents himself modestly in the book as having had 2 or 3 years' experience with the needy, that he had actually spent about a quarter of a century in that particular work. At the same time, he was faced with a family trauma. Catherine Booth, who had stood with him and preached with him and done other things, was dying of what I believe was cancer at the time. And so he was caught with the trauma of a tragedy at home and tragedy on the street. So he reached out within Darkest England to do two things. One, to portray the terrible conditions into which the poor and the needy had fallen, and two, to prescribe ways in which that situation could be rectified. Now, as I will repeat myself several times here, here is the saving factor of Booth's book. He takes less than 100 pages to describe the sin of the country, less than 100 pages to describe the sin of the country, and almost 200 pages to prescribe the way out of the country. Notes that from his free food stations between 1888 and 1890, they served in excess of 3 million meals, helped in excess of 4 million persons, one way, shape, form, or another. And now Booth says what we have to do is simply expand this effort beyond our limited means to a broader means. So having pointed out the number of people who died in London from suicide, and the number that poisoned themselves, and the number that killed others, and all sorts of things, he said, now we need to attach around the town colony centers to which people may come who have great need. And out of those colony centers, we will find farms and whatnot and other places where they can be taught and educated and self-help. I can't go into detail on it, obviously, but it was really an elaborate system Booth proposed for bringing people to the point where they could have help. And that help would not just be to make them slobs that would live in a freeloading society. It would be help to get them established so that they could live and be productive citizens. That's interesting, don't you think? Booth knew the folly of a system that just gave it out, so he wanted to sell it, pass it, use it, and develop people along those lines. All factors of society would work in it, church, state, industry, and all other factors too. Booth went into that by developing a match factory and the making of safety matches against the society in which people were dying from eating too much phosphorus and the making of matches and various other things. Too complicated for a poor layman like myself, but it indicated Booth's willingness to attempt to bring industry and the church and all other forces to work in the problem. Now, the particular nature of the book itself is just that, what the problem is and what the potential solutions are. And the potential solutions are built against what has worked or what has been operative for the benefit of the nation. Now, what was the influence of In Darkest England? I can only tell you what the books and the magazines say. It wasn't there, you understand. But they say that the first half of it, the first third of it, whatever it is, scandalized London and British society. British society liked to deny that such things existed. Like in our day, they'd like to deny that there was any race prejudice in London, but tons of it abounds there. They wanted to deny it, but the book brought it to the forefront in a way that nobody could miss. And it greatly irritated. It caused a stir of debate and argument in Parliament and a great deal of anxious moments. So it stimulated by pointing out a sore that could not be denied. And then, although nobody really followed Booth's system exactly, it gave ideas what could be done, and lots of things were done by the government and some by industry and some by other church groups too. But I'll tell you what really happened. A lot was done by many wealthy people suddenly contributing to the Salvation Army. I'm not saying that the book made them rich, but it brought to them a great deal of help that they did not have otherwise, and they invested that not only in England, but around the world in army missions here, there, and many other places. So the influence of Booth's book was simply amazing. It shook the government, shook the nation, shook the churches, and resulted in an enormous amount of social outreach for the poor. And as I said a few moments ago, it was not like Rauschenbusch. It was not a social outreach that if a man was dressed up, he was fit for God. It was a social outreach intended to make it more possible for him to know Jesus and the truths that the Lord proclaimed. The thing that worked with Darkest England was the realism and practicality of the book.
And my note is that we can profit by that, but making sure that when we're dealing with these issues, it's not enough to say how many drug addicts and how many AIDS victims there are in the country. There's got to be some positive treatment and outreach to those that have desperate needs. And if we can bring realism and practical things together, then we too might give something to shock the nation. Now, the last of these books I'm considering is The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. Lindsey's name is correctly spelled S-E-Y for those who think I've made another typing mistake. I looked them up for half an hour one day over L-I-N-D-S-A-Y. That shows you how intelligent we are sometimes in the seminary life. But Lindsey is a contemporary author, and so less is known about them. The world doesn't know a lot about you until you've been dead 10 years at least, and maybe 100 years they know a lot more. But he got started in lecturing on prophetic subjects about 1957, out largely on the West Coast, where he served as a worker with Campus Crusade, giving talks in churches and on campuses. Bible prophecy was his thing. Apparently it was a carryover from his studies at Dallas, of which he's a graduate, and he continued to minister along those particular lines. Now, Lindsey found, he tells us in his own words, a great lethargy when it came to prophetic studies and the condition of the world. So he wanted to do something about that, and along with the editorial advice of C.C. Carlson, wrote the book The Late Great Planet Earth. That's about all I can say of Lindsey. He continues to head up a foundation in California to this day, which makes studies and research along biblical lines, some good, some not so good, as I see goodness, you understand. Now, the book itself, The Late Great Planet Earth, is first of all a study of fulfilled prophecy regarding the coming of Jesus. And then it is an appreciation of prophetic things that will happen in the future based against the fact that God did what he said he would do with regard to the coming of Jesus. He takes off from the apologetic point of view that prophecy is real, and that if you study the prophecies and the coming of Jesus, you'll see how God fulfills his word. Now, says Lindsey, seeing how God did that, believe that God will do that in the future too. And so having made that kind of an interrelationship between the two, he proceeds on the basis of what had happened to discuss what he thinks will happen. And so he takes the biblical analysis and sees things that will happen in the Middle East and in Europe and other places, sounds a general alarm that Satan is getting a dominance over things, that the Antichrist is going to rule things, and challenges people very much to consider the program of God. And not all of us agree with all of Lindsey's prophetic analysis, but that's what the book does. In the last chapter of the book, he gives some of his own prophecies, most of which are general enough that any of you could give them too. But he gives a few towards the end of it and sprinkles a few throughout it. But that's the nature of the book, from the truth of what God has done to the prediction of what he believes God will do as he understands things. The influence of The Late Great Planet Earth cannot be overestimated either. Whether you like the book or not is beside the point. In the first 3 years after it was printed, in the first 3 years of its production, over 2 million copies of it were sold. That number, I was told yesterday by phone, had passed the 5 million mark in volumes printed and sold. It outsold every book on the New York Best Times bestseller list for months and months and months. The only book for about 1 year that sold more copies than Lindsey was the Bible itself. That's what we're told. You don't find those things in the secular press. They don't mention the sale of Christian literature for lots of different reasons. But the book had an enormous thrust that way. It stimulated the study into prophecy even by people who disagreed with Lindsey and thought his scheme was crazy. Stimulated it powerfully and, incidentally, touched a lot of people with the thrust of the gospel. I think of all the Christian literature in the last 50 years, nothing has had quite the forceful impact that this book had, whether you agree with it or not. That's just the simple fact of the matter. I myself have had a dozen students, and I didn't count them. I can very easily count them, and it might be more than that, who were won or converted or alarmed to seek the Lord by reading Lindsey's book and the fearful things that he talks about. And he doesn't talk about them fearfully. He talks about them as certain disasters, and the implications are made from that particular point. So the influence of it was huge on two lines. First, turning people to think about eternal things, and second, awakening the Christian community to a further study of prophecy. And some of that further study of prophecy has gone directly opposite to Lindsey's ideas, but I'm in a circumstance where I think anything that makes the people of God study more is good. If they come to different conclusions, you take that risk. And so the increased interest in a biblical study of those things and the application to them to our age, I think, is a strike for the positive side of the influence of Lindsey's work. I mentioned that the book is aimed at interested but uncommitted individuals. It's not aimed for the professors in seminary. They can read it, I suppose, and a lot of them can learn from it, I suppose, but it's not aimed to them. It's aimed to the general line of Christian people who are just kind of oozing through the course of life. So I make two or three observations on it. While its thrust is just short of sensational, being written in a lively, non-pedantic style, it's easily read, easily gripped, and the message is ferociously clear. Many other books try to simulate that, but somehow Lindsay, with Carlson's help, in this book, I don't feel so firmly about his later books, but in this book, he somehow has graphically pulled together those things. A non-pedantic, but informative and forceful sort of style. And that has helped make the book the first that it is. Now, I can't say much more about that. The clock is pushing us pretty heavily right now. But I've talked about four books, and now I want to draw some conclusions and observations with regard to those four and what we learn from them as far as our literary world is concerned. The ideal literature or media presentation is one that will be bold, logical, quickly understandable, and have an appeal that is neither provincial nor esoteric. That's written out in the middle of page 7, so I don't have to say it again. But that's the ideal type of literature. I can't write that type. There's no point in arguing about it. I can't write it. But men and women who do write need to think along those lines. I have trouble signing my name in a meaningful way. But men and women who do write need to think along those lines. By looking at the literature that shook the world, we learn that boldness and logical qualities, understandability, and appeal that is not limited to a particular scope, we learn that those things comprise characteristics that make that literature powerful and active in which it is. The type of literature that does that is built on recognized historical circumstance. But it doesn't just recognize the circumstance, it provides the answers. And whether you're looking at Booth, or at Bunyan, or at Lex Rex, or at Lindsay, you see the problems, but you see the answers. How will the government be ordered? Let there be a covenant between the rulers and the people, and here's how you'll work it out. We miss that a tremendous amount in contemporary evangelical literature, largely by presenting a mono-sided sort of thing. We're great at singing the blues, but not so great at putting the right notes in. I won't elaborate on that, I think, or I might have to play the harmonica again. Now, this ideal type of literature will criticize, all right, but it does it in a building way. It will generalize in theory, but it will be specific in practice. It may not show what you would call common sense exactly, but it will take the reading sense of the hearer and galvanize it into some particular type of action. Whether it's written in a genre of a poem or a novel or a satire, it doesn't make any difference. It will shake the world. I've compared these things, for example, with literature like the literature I enjoy, compared with Tolkien. I enjoy Tolkien enormously. Tolkien, however, will not shake the world. He will move a few thinkers because the esoteric nature of it automatically removes it from the rank and file of about 80% of the people. The same thing is true, believe it or not, of C.S. Lewis. He will move a few academic minds powerfully for God, but he will not shake the world because he works at a pedantic level that many persons simply can't cope with. Somehow the literature that's ideal bridges those things. Maybe the people who can write that way have to be born that way. I don't really know. I don't seem to be able to do it. But I kind of know that in comparison, there's much good literature that's useful. But its usefulness is very much limited, either by being pedantic, either by being pedantic, or by being technical, or being provincial, or having a very limited appeal. So, since we can't often create the ideal, does that mean we should produce no media work at all? Since I can't give the perfect television program, should I give none? No, the answer is, to know what the standards are that we ought to shoot for, and forgive me for saying it, but just do the best we can. But we ought to have those things in mind. We ought to be avoiding the provincial and the things that are not graphically realized as much as we can and doing the best that we're allowed to do providentially and circumstantially. In my life, I've learned to accept the marvel of mediocrity. If you can't be a superlative, then be the best mediocre you can. And if you're not good enough to be mediocre, then try to be a decent inferior. But whatever the case is, set your goal in the media world on those things that have been successful in shaking the world. Well, here we are just a few people. We may not be able to shake a nut tree and get walnuts in the fall.
We may not shake the world, but you don't know. Booth was an almost unknown Methodist preacher. Bunyan was a guy who hung around jail. Rutherford was a fellow who preached long sermons. I don't know what Lindsay is doing, I hate to think. But whatever the circumstances are, you never can tell. If we know what it is that God has used to move things powerfully, then at least we can set our goals in that direction. And that's really what I wanted to say in this talk of literature that shook the world, with the hope that we would learn something of the kind of characteristics that ought to mark our use of media subjects, whether it be literature or a big debate or a television program or whatever it happens to be, and thereby increase the effectiveness of what we're doing. Well, that's the end of my formal remarks, and I think that's just about the end of this tape. So we hope you'll have a nice time of refreshments. Eat an extra cookie for me.